Hello everyone and welcome to our new episode at Ruby India. A bit about Ruby India. Ruby India tries to bring together curated content from and for the Ruby Indian community and friends. We do a regular newsletter highlighting content from the people from the community. And one of the aims is highlighting people and bringing together their work, which is one of the reasons that has led us to start us with this podcast. On this podcast, we have a special guest. Since we have been traveling a bit, we came across Fabio. He's from Brazil. So it's a very special podcast that we're having today. I'll let Fabio introduce himself a bit about himself.
Okay, so thank you. And thank you, everybody, for listening to this podcast. I hope everybody's studying and enjoying it. And thanks for the invitation to be part of it. And let me try to be very short in the introduction because we can speak about it all day long. But I've been working with Ruby particularly since 2005 probably. Mm-hmm. I'm a Java developer working on integration with ERP systems, SAP, and big corporation stuff. I've been involved in the first internet bubble crash of the year 2000, so I've known startups since then. And even before that, in the 90s, I was involved in with big publicity agencies doing experimentation on what consumer internet should be. So I've been working with technology for a long time now. And in terms of the Rails and Ruby community in particular, I started blogging. It was 2006. Back then, Brazil basically had no idea what Ruby or Rails were. I actually had to start from scratch. Basically, there were like, I don't know, a dozen people spread around the country doing some hobby-level Ruby programming, but mm-hmm. No one was taking it seriously back then. So just so you have an idea, Brazil is a country that has almost 200 million people, so it's not as big as India. We're more, in terms of geographical area, we're like the USA in terms of size. So, and the Brazilian market, the Latin America market, is very small compared to the USA.
Right.
But we do have some internal market. But most of the time, they try to mimic what the US is doing, primarily in the consulting, big consulting firms such as Accenture. So primarily Java, .NET, so
right.
No Ruby, even other Python or other languages were not that ubiquitous back then. So I decided to bootstrap this community here in Brazil, and the whole idea was to bring more people to join new stuff, not only being a Rubyist. I think the whole idea of Ruby in Brazil, and I think the community is on that track, is that we never intended the Ruby community to be a leave Java behind or leave .NET behind and do Ruby full time. So we've been pitching that idea since 2006, 2007. Mm-hmm. And one thing that most people may not realize is that I think if you started with Rails like at least 5 years ago, you probably saw the DH8's 15-minute blog video, the right. Whoops video. Remember that one?
Yeah.
Yeah, that one was fun, and it got viral back then. And it was actually recorded in a Brazilian conference here in Porto Alegre. Yeah. So we have a history of open source conferences. There's one called FISLID, which is the International Forum of Free Software, if you translate it. And DH8 was invited by the first Rubyist in Brazil. He actually came five when he was still on Rails 0.5 or something like that. I think it was exactly when he just released the initial public version. So he came here. There were no Rubyists. So he actually presented that video to Python developers that had nothing else to do. And when you watch that video, imagine DHH pitching to Python developers that basically did not want to know what Ruby is. So the fun part, the irony of it is that the video got so viral that it spread like fire all over the world. And people like me got that video later, Then I met some Brazilian friends that told that story later, and that was, if you watch the video, it's actually written, recorded 2005 in Fisley, yes. Brazil. So that was the,
I never
the
knew about it.
Exactly. And after that, I started blogging, and I decided that for something like Rails to be taken seriously, for example, by university professors or some maverick project manager that wants new technology, they had to have something more solid than just a blog. Then I decided to write the first book on Rails. And the way I did it is I actually, because there were no documentation, good documentation back then,
right.
Only the Dave Thomas Agile Web Development with Rails book. So I decided to actually learn Rails properly with Ruby while I was actually writing the book. So I got the Rails source code. I read the entire source code to understand how it worked.
Yeah.
And by the time I finished understanding the source code, I had a book ready to print. And then the whole idea was to have it as soon as possible so people had something to refer to than just a blog. And after that, we did a smallish conference meeting. It was actually a meetup. Maybe 50 people attended. And some of those people nowadays, who were they? We had Fabio Conde, who now works at Heroku. We had the guys that co-founded Plataforma Tech, from where you know Giuseppe and the other people. So you had Carlos Vilela, who represents Thoughtworks in Brazil.
Mm-hmm.
And so there were a bunch of very interesting people that are still doing great things nowadays.
Yep.
And after that, a big company called LocalWeb. LocalWeb is like Brazilian Rackspace or DreamHost. Yeah, so they kind of got interested in Rails. They contacted me, and after a few conversations, I got hired there, and we decided together to co-organize a conference called Rails Summit Latin America to become something that mimics RailsConf in the U.S. in a smaller scale for the Brazilian community. And that was 2008. We had, like, I don't know, 400 attendees or something like that. Then the conference evolved. Yeah, the conference evolved. The whole idea of having Rails Summit as the name was because no one knew what Ruby is in 2008. But Rails got a name, got a good name spreading around in different communities, mostly of Java and .NET people saying that Rails was not worth it. So at least they knew it existed. And the idea was using Rails Summit for 2 years, then switch to RubyConf. Then people would know what Ruby is already. So 2010 was when we made the switch. And this year we had the seventh edition of RubyConf Brazil, which you, Vido, and Paul, and Pradamesh, and Rishi came all the way from India to participate. That was great.
Yeah, that was pretty amazing.
Yeah, and the whole idea is to have people coming from out of Brazil also to show Brazilians that Rails is being used everywhere, different experiences, different circumstances. It's not only Silicon Valley and fancy tech startups. So we've been doing that kind of communication ever since. So I think this is a very, very short introduction of how we started.
Yeah. And at the conference, actually, I was a bit taken aback because I saw, I had not pictured it enough, but I saw that a lot of, the Rails and Ruby community over there is actually pretty huge.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
And what I said at my closing keynote, that I think the whole point, and to summarize it, because it was the 10th anniversary of Ruby on Rails, so Ruby on Rails itself was able to survive and flourish for 10 years.
Exactly.
And I think when DH8 started teaching Rails, he used it to quote a Gandhi quote, something like, I don't remember the quote right now, but the whole idea was no one at first no one cares. Then they start to criticize it. Then they start to fight it, and finally you win. Yeah, exactly. Something on that line. And I can say that we won because when most people think of winning, they actually think of obliterating the competition, for example. So for Rails to win, we have to make Java. We have to destroy Java or destroy PHP or, of course, my closing keynote this year was to say that we won because we are on par now with everybody else. So we exist in the same space. It's not a shame to use Rails. It's not something that you use because you're a rebel or you have something, you don't like other technologies.
Yeah.
So we now have projects that use Rails integrated with Java stuff, integrated with, of course, JavaScript stuff. And we exist in a market of our own, so we are legitimate, and we can exist on the same space. And in the last 10 years, that's what we proved, that we can deliver good software with good design, with good processes, and good best practices. So the last 10 years proved it, that Rails and Ruby and this community can actually improve the way we do software in the world.
So I'll ask some more questions about yourself, actually. It's been like, how many, 10 years? No, wait, 2006.
For myself, it was 8 years. Yeah,
eight years. Ruby. Oh, wow. So you started with LocaWeb, and then you started with CodeMiner. So it's something about that.
Yeah, actually, I started with, I was doing SAP consultancy, as I said. Mm-hmm. And in 2007, I got into a company called SurgeWorks. It was a Utah consultancy. It was the first Brazilian outsource. We made a team of developers here in Brazil. Then I spent a year, more than a year, doing consultancy in Rails for U.S. companies. After that, I joined LocaWeb from 2008 to 2010. Then I joined another consultancy in Brazil to test the market and see if I would be able to build a growing team. So we already had iOS growing, Android growing, so new technologies in that space as well. So I was in charge of creating a team that started with like 3 developers, and in a year and a half, we were able to grow to 25 developers. So the market was really
which is pretty huge.
It is huge, exactly. And 2010, the coincidence is that in Brazil, it kind of started a new growth in tech startups. So 2010 onwards, we've been in a tech startup. I wouldn't call it a bubble, but of course it was a growth that we didn't see in a long time. So new technologies such as Rails were able to use that trend to actually grow. And after that other consultancy, it was September 2011 when myself and 2 other friends, we decided to open our own consultancy company.
Right.
Completing 3 years of existence.
Okay, so the 25 ones, it was at previous startup.
Sorry?
The growth of 25, this is not from CodeMiner? I thought it was from CodeMiner.
So CodeMiner, I was working as an employee for another consultancy that was doing traditional Java PHP development. So I bootstrapped a department from 3 developers to 25 and several big clients. And when we started CodeMiner, we started from scratch. So it was myself, 2 partners, and 2 developers. And in 3 years, we had
50.
Now we have 45 developers
in
4 different physical offices.
That's a huge growth.
So we've been working hard in the last few years.
That's like pretty huge growth. Anyway, so I wanted to hear also a bit about you've been involved in the community, and like you said, you were involved also in writing the book and reading the Rails project when it came in. So Wanted to hear a bit about your open source environment.
Right. Yeah. I was mostly involved in open source. I'm not a good open source developer, so I have to say that right out of the bat, because nowhere near José Valin or Rafael Francis.
It doesn't mean you don't need to. You don't need to be.
I think some of my initial contributions were specifically geared towards bringing Brazilians to the Ruby community, and in the beginning, I knew that it would be difficult because the way Brazilians learn technologies through traditional courses and classes and reading books in Portuguese, so. Yeah. They were not used for at this, how can I say, our routine of learning everything from the source, going to the GitHub repo, reading the README page, and learning from there. Brazilians were more used to wait for Brazilian Portuguese books and classes.
Yeah, I understand that.
That's a big problem. For example, in the first Rails Summit, we had like 400 people. We brought several speakers such as Chad Fowler, Obi Fernandez, Rich Kilmer, David Chelimsky, all the big names. And of course we had to have at that real-time audio English to Portuguese translation, and I don't know, two-thirds of the attendees had those phones to understand what they were speaking.
So now they can understand.
Yeah, so fast forward 7 years. And now I think, I don't know, maybe out of 1,000 people, maybe a dozen require the audio translation. So we had a huge shift in generations that we bootstrapped in 2007, 2008. So at that time, I was mainly involved, for example, in translating material, translating documentation. It was before Rails guides, for example. So the first thing we translated was the Getting Real book. Remember the Getting Real book from 37 Signals? So because I believe that not only technology, but the inspiration for the beautiful code design and the idea of tech startups were important for the developers. So we decided to translate the Getting Real book. It was the first translation out of English. After that, then we had all the other languages.
I never knew about it.
It was the first one. So I think even DHH were not thinking about anything like that. But after the Brazilian one, then everybody wanted to translate for their own countries. So then we translated the Learning to Program with Ruby. I don't remember the author now. I'm gonna send you the link. You can put in the show notes.
Sure.
But it was a very smallish book on learning a little bit about Ruby. Then a friend of mine that worked with me, one of the guys that I actually converted from .NET to Ruby, and now it's a very well-known name in Brazil, Carlos Brando, he translated the Weiss Point and Guide to Ruby, for example. So we had that translated in Portuguese as well. And after that, Git was a new thing that almost nobody knew about outside of the kernel development. And yeah. I was also evangelizing Git in Brazil since 2006, 2007. And yeah, something like that. So in 2008, I invited Chris Wanstroth. He was about to release GitHub Beta. Rails was still not in GitHub yet. So when we brought him here, GitHub was still a garage startup. And because of that, I knew that most companies would never use GitHub at that time. I don't even think they already had the private repositories or something like that. So the other project that was available was called Gitorious. I don't know if
you remember. Yeah, I know.
It was a GitHub clone for public repositories.
Right.
Something that could be used inside a corporation. So I wrote the entire administration part of Gitorious that they never had because it was just intended for public repositories. And after that, I think Nokia took over that chain, and they collaborated a lot on Gitorious at that time. Mm-hmm. It was before GitLab, for example. The problem was that Dettorios was always had a very, very difficult setup. So it was very difficult to install. And then GitLab came, and then the all the virtual machine images stuff actually picked up, and it became easier. Then I did other things. For example, when Rails first got the internationalization support, then I was one of the first to actually collaborate on all the translations to have Rails ready for Brazilian Portuguese. Several other people collaborated back then. I worked primarily on those bits that helped the Brazilian community have a more smooth transition to use Rails technologies. At that time, I think Plataforma Tech was already starting. I think then José Valim released the first versions of inherited resources. Mm-hmm. I think I collaborated on Resource Controller, which was before that, something like that. And then all the restful discussions started. Myself and the people from Plataforma and some other developers in Brazil, we were trying to make a replacement for Active Resource. I actually talked about that at RailsConf Baltimore 2010. Unfortunately, our idea was too big, and mm-hmm. the Rails way actually were more simpler. It was easier. Yeah, it was simpler. I think we overdid it. We over-engineered. So that's why it's not worth using that project right now.
And I had one question about
your experiment.
Yeah, I had one question about the localization part you were saying. Like, when I was in Brazil, I see that a lot of businesses are actually more focused on. I didn't find any product which was based in English. So Portuguese, where everything is in Portuguese and Rails to be having Rails to have a foothold, it is very essential to have the translations thing. So when initially Rails was not having that support, what was your involvement or what basically used to happen in that case in Brazil?
Yeah, not only myself but several other Rails developers in Brazil, we jumped right in the beginning to make. I think the translation support came with Rails 2. I think it was around that time. It was 2008, I think, around there. It was 2.1, I think. So right from the beginning, we had not only the translations, the string translations, but also some other developers had libraries to deal with the equivalent in Brazil of a social security number. Something
correct.
we have some other documentations and IDs and checkings that Brazilians have to do for bureaucracy that had to be implemented. So some of our developers in the community developed libraries to support that. So right out of the bat, it was not perfect, but it was totally possible to make Brazilian Portuguese applications with not only internationalization but also localization, so currency and data right. formats and all other subtleties in which is not only one-to-one string translation.
So this was in 2007, 2008 kind.
Yeah. So documentation and stuff like that.
Yeah, you can imagine.
Okay.
Moving on. Like, I would like to know a bit about. So, in your day-to-day work or day-to-day programming, what all tools do you use or what kind of setup do you have? This is generally a question that we ask everyone. So,
sure. I think my personal development machine right now, for example, I always use the Mac.
From 2006.
No, from 2004, actually.
Oh.
It was a year before the Apple switched from the PowerPC to Intel processor. So, and it was difficult because I was doing Java development. Mm-hmm. Java and Eclipse, for example, were not well suited for PowerPC processors. And anyway, and we still had several Windows-only applications.
Yes.
But after that, and especially because of Rails, it was a coincidence because DH8 pitched the Mac so hard, and it was a good fit. So I used TextMate, since OS X Tiger. Nowadays, I use a Mac, MacBook Pro with the newest OS X, and I have Homebrew installed, for example, but I don't use it as extensively as before. Okay. Nowadays, I prefer to use Vagrant to control virtual machines in VMware Fusion, so I have a very isolated Ubuntu-based environment that I can actually... I don't have any mismatches between OS X, and then I deploy to production, and production is Linux, and something goes wrong. So everything is Linux-based. I think for those kinds of developments, I think that's the best way. But I still edit all the source code and.
So is this the thing that you're mentioning about Vagrant? Is this open source somewhere, or you have published it somewhere?
Okay, so Vagrant. Vagrant is just a wrapper.
No, I mean about the environment you're speaking. It's published somewhere?
What's published?
So you mentioned you use Vagrant for creating your own environment. Is it published somewhere?
Oh, okay. So my Vagrant configuration. Oh, I think I published that, but I think it's already obsolete. I have to actually update it.
Okay.
I've been tweaking
it. Would be nice to see it.
Yeah. You're right. And outside of Vagrant, I use MacVim because I like to use Vim. Vim is the best one. But my guys use Sublime Text, and some use. I think I have one guy that uses Emacs nowadays. But anyway, I think most developers are starting already directly on Sublime Text.
Yeah, I saw your T-shirt. The CodeMiner T-shirt has Vim written on it.
Yes. Vim is great. Emacs, you have to have like four tentacles to do all the shortcuts. And VI is very simple. That's you can do VI like this. So this is VI, right?
Yeah. That from that, like coming to the next question is about what all different things do you use in your company or to achieve communication or workflow management, or what kind of different tools do you use for projects?
So CodeMiner is a very, very, its structure is very flat. So I have the myself and the other partners. I have two guys from commercial, and I have all the developers, and that's it. I don't have anyone entitled as managers, coordinators, supervisors, or whatever. We have teams working with clients. And I have four offices in four geographically separated locations. And the teams actually are people from all those offices together. So most of them are remote teams all the time. Mm-hmm. I don't have an entire project done in one office, for example. Okay. So our main line of communication for is Slack app.
Okay.
So Slack is like a fancy IRC or something like that.
Yeah.
And I like that one for daily meetings. The developers use Hangout to see each other and discuss what they're going to do throughout the day or if it's a sprint planning. So they use Hangout with the team and with the client.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, email is another way of communication that we always use, but primarily Slack. Then for the projects, we use Pivotal Tracker. I think it's still the best one. It's the most organized, the simpler to use, and gives everybody the best information they need at hand. For the development, we use, of course, GitHub repositories, mm-hmm. private repositories. After the project is done, delivered, and closed, we archive it on Bitbucket. So GitHub only have the active projects. We like GitHub because of everything about GitHub, of course, but also because it integrates very well with other tools, such as we use Travis for continuous integration. We mm-hmm. use CodeClimate for the code quality and code assessment. We use... I think I'm missing one. Damn, I think I forgot one too, but anyway.
Yeah, the picture.
Yeah. And all of those have hooks with Slack, so people receive the notifications if the build broke or something like that. Oh, of course, Heroku for deployment most of the time.
Oh, right.
only if the client is have a very customized infrastructure, then we go use EC2 and stuff like that. But most of the time, for small and medium clients, we use Heroku all the time.
Interesting. Yeah. In closing, I would like to ask about. So this is kind of an to get an insight of how the Brazilian community grew and how it could help us out also. Like, you told us about how from 2006 you have seen a lot of changes in the community. So a bit about that and like what has helped you to grow this community a lot in Brazil, in terms of Brazil.
You mean how they
a bit about how it grew and what helped you for building the community.
Okay, so I think the initial reaction was Brazilians are very conservative in terms of career. So at least in the until 2008, at least most developers would go to college. They would get their graduation. They would enter a big software factory or a big corporation that has IT departments, and they would grow from there. Usually learning just one stack, so only .NET or only Java, and I would use that for the rest of my life. Yep. And from 2008 and going forward, I think what really helped change the shape of the market were the tech startups.
Right.
So we started a few years before the tech startups. So the same way as in Silicon Valley, if you go to San Francisco, you in 2008, you would see Twitter done in Rails, Groupon done in Rails, Living Social, SlideShare, Shopify, so everyone else. So and Brazilians noticed that we already had a group of developers willing to do Rails. Then mm-hmm. we have a new generation of entrepreneurs trying to build good development teams. And what we would define as good teams were developers with agile mindsets, with practice in extreme programming routines, for example, code reviews and
yes.
having tests and continuous integration, continuous deployment. So all those practices were only well established in the Rails community. No other community embrace those practices as much as the Rails community. So the whole notion of having a good tech startup, one that build a good product that can scale, that can be maintained, that can be sustainable, was using those kinds of teams. So having started the Rails community before and having the tech startups starting right after that, it was a good marriage, and I think that helped the entire community grow very fast.
Yep. Before I forget, so I forgot to ask you about what all different community engagement or community events helped you out along the way, like for growing the community.
So I think the whole idea I was explaining that in I personally did, for example, 100 talks in at least 15 to 20 different cities.
Yeah.
From north to south of Brazil, so mainly universities. So in Brazil, I don't know if it's a very old tradition, but every university, they separate 1 week every year to have companies and professors and entrepreneurs and people mm-hmm. going there to talk to students, to pitch what the market is doing, what they think they should do, what should they study. So it's a week where students, instead of having classes, they attend those talks. And so I spoke on many of those in the last 8 years. That accounts for the more than 100 talks. Cool. So I've been evangelizing to students for a long time. Some of those students, I don't know, for example, 3 years ago, I met students in one city, and now they are already graduated, and I'm hiring them. So I've been planting and doing some seeding all over the country. So other developers did the same in their own regions. And some of those regions created what we call gurus. Gurus in Portuguese is Grupo de Usuarios, which is all a name for user group. So it's just it's a local user group. So for example, São Paulo has Guru SP for São Paulo user group. And then you have Ceará user group, Natal user group. So several mailing lists that are now moving, I don't know, to Facebook pages or groups or something like that. And they are usually around universities or tech startups. And so they try to help each other in their own regions. And now, in the beginning, we had some other small events besides RubyConf, for example, Rio on Rails, Ceará on Rails. But usually what happens is that the community gets too excited too fast, and they try to build something too big at once and make one big conference. But then they burn out very fast.
Exactly.
And they lose steam very fast. So what's been sustaining more is those small meetups. So some company provides space for 20 people to come in a Thursday night or something like that and do some talks. Mm-hmm. I think that format has been more persistent over the years. And now after a few years without other big conferences besides RubyConf, now we have April Pro Ruby.
Right.
We are now having RuPy, which is a convergence of not only Ruby but Python communities. Yeah. So RuPy is one of those. Node.js is on board as well. I think RuPy was originated in Europe or something like that.
They
changed the names now because it's not only Ruby and Python anymore. I think Brazil is going to do that soon. But we had some RuPies already here in Brazil. Brazil is not very well known for good, big development conferences. Most of the conferences that we had before RubyConf were commercially driven conferences, such as Microsoft Conference, Oracle Conference, which were more... they were corporate. The only purpose was for them to showcase... their own products, exactly. So they were not community-driven conferences.
Yep. So in finishing, we ask people what people would like to hear from you, and we have two questions over here.
Sure.
So one of them is, which Prathamesh is asking, is what is the importance of meeting with people? Like you said you've given like 100 talks. Which is
I think people underestimate the whole notion of meeting people because most of the time, especially the new generation of developers, they can learn anything from Googling. So they can just go to Google. If they're just starting, they go to Khan Academy, to Code Academy, to Code School, and several other of those places. They can reach a very big set of material. So this is one thing that new generation can do. They don't even need to go to college anymore. They can learn anything because it's all available.
Yeah.
It's really all available. So they can pay, they can download for free or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem is that they are only learning the engineering part. And the engineering part in any project is at most 20% of the problem. So even those... The largest project or the smallest project, the engineering part is only 20%.
Right.
The rest of the 80% is all about communication, which developers hate. So I tend to say that developers, if they were a network protocol, they would be UDP. They just shoot information. And they don't mind if the other end acknowledges that or not. So communication has to be like TCP. You send a package, you wait for acknowledgement, then you send another. But communication with developers is not like that. They just shoot information. And that's the whole notion of tweeting. Just tweet it, forget about it. If you listened, good for you. And that's the problem. Projects can't be done without human interaction. And the problem with human interaction is that, especially in a country as big as Brazil, culturally we are very different north from south. So if you go way north, you're going to see people that are very easygoing, that are very friendly. If you go way south, people are more they're more serious, I think. I think they're more direct. And then if you mix the two and make them collide, it makes for very, very funny situations. And in conference such as RubyConf, for example, I asked the audience, how many of you are from outside of São Paulo, which is one of our main cities? And I think nowadays, most of them, I think, were out of São Paulo, from all the other states, actually. So it was a mix of cultures and a mix of experiences that you will not realize until you meet those people and ask them. Or, for example, you share your experience. I've been trying to do Rails. I had this kind of difficulties. I don't know, my manager sucks. People usually like to complain about that. And my coworker do code without testing. I want to kill that guy. And then the other guy says, oh, I know how we dealt with it in our company. We did something like this. Why don't you try that? And that kind of insight does not come reading a book. It does not come from reading a blog post. It only comes with the serendipity of mix and matching different situation and conversation. The conference is a especially good place for that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can understand. Then we have Eduardo, who is asking you if there are any books you would like to recommend for reading. He's asking about computer science fundamentals, but in general, any book that you would recommend for reading.
Right. So I think the one book that's very accessible, and if you had to choose, because there are many good books, so don't take this answer as this is the only book I have to read. But for example, try the Code Complete, the original Code Complete book. They have some techniques. And then also pair that book with The Mythical Man from Fred Brooks. So those are two sides. One is just technical. That's the trivial part, because you can read that, you can practice, you can read code. And the other part is The Mythical Man Month is a book that's very underestimated because it was written in the 60s.
Yeah.
It was from Fred Brooks working on the OS 364 mainframe. So most new generation ask, oh, what can this old user tell me about software development that I still don't know? And the surprise is that I can bet that most people listening to this podcast already made all the mistakes that Fred Brooks had documented in that book 50 years ago.
Thanks.
So go read that book and avoid having yourself in the same situation that everybody's making the same mistakes all over again. So I think that one, The Mythical Man Month, would be the best one to start.
Got it. All right. We are mostly out of time.
Okay.
Yep. Thanks a lot for, giving us time. It was pretty hard to get it. Get your time, because you're running like 50 people company. It's I appreciate it a lot that you've given us time. So
I appreciate it.
Yep. Thanks a lot.
No, thank you very much for listening and having the time to go through all of this, and I hope to share more experience with all of you later.
Sure. Thanks again. Bye.
Okay, thank you. See ya. Bye-bye.